When your furnace quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of Care Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win a BBB Torch Award for ethics and be recognized as Lennox's Partner of the Year in 2024. So call Care Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com when you need a company you can trust.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
As one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're exploring the extraordinary world of William Blake, visionary artist and poet, and we'll be finding out how this radical thinker embraced the world of fantasy, myth, and the supernatural. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. William Blake is one of the most original and enigmatic figures of the Romantic period. During his lifetime, he was often dismissed as eccentric, even mad. Yet today he is recognised as one of the most radical creative minds of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Blake refused to separate art and literature. Instead, he fused image and text into a single imaginative universe filled with angels, demons, mythological figures, and prophetic visions. A new exhibition at the National Gallery of Ireland, William Blake, The Age of Romantic Fantasy, has opened. It's running until the 19th of July, and it brings together more than 100 works, including Blake's paintings, drawings and prints, alongside works by other key figures and artists of the period. By placing Blake among his contemporaries and followers, the exhibition explores how artists across Ireland and Britain grappled with a rapidly changing world, often turning to fantasy, myth, and the supernatural. And so in tonight's show, we want to explore the life, work, and legacy of William Blake. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Anne Hodge is curator of prints and drawings at the National Gallery of Ireland and is an expert on printmaking, photography, landscape drawing and topography, and sustainability within museums. The creator of many wonderful exhibitions, including the recent Turner exhibition, she is also the co-creator of this William Blake exhibition. Dr. Alice Inslee is curator of British art, 1730 to 1850, at Tate Modern and the co-creator of the William Blake exhibition. She's an expert on British art and visual culture of the late 18th and early 19th centuries, with particular interests in Romanticism, print culture, and the work of William Blake. Dr. Christina Morin is Professor of English at the University of Limerick, where she is also Assistant Dean of Research for the Faculty of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences. An expert in Irish Gothic literature, she's the author of the Gothic novel in Ireland. And all three of our panel tonight, Alice, Tina and Anne, wrote the beautifully illustrated book William Blake, The Age of Romantic Fantasy, which accompanies the exhibition. Well, you are all very welcome. And Anne, I might begin with you, and I might begin with just a very big question of who is William Blake?
William Blake was an English artist and one of those figures or characters that a lot of people are aware of. They've heard of him. Maybe they know his poetry. Maybe they're familiar from their school days of that great poem, Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright in the Forests of the Night. Or anyone who did English in college will be very familiar with Blake, primarily as a writer. But he was also a very brilliant and unique visual artist. And that's what we're looking at through this exhibition, William Blake, The Age of Romantic Fantasy.
And if you are a fan of U2, you will also know the titles, at least, of some of his works, because Songs of Innocence and then of Experience, inspired by the collections of poetry of William Blake.
That's right. U2 used two of his books of poetry, which was conflated into one a bit later. And the band were very interested in his thinking, his philosophy, and his openness to new ideas, I guess. So in 2014 and 2017, they based those two albums on his work.
And what I find extraordinary is that he's someone who's had this incredible legacy. He's influenced so many writers and thinkers, and he's had, you know, a truly international legacy. And yet in his own lifetime, he seems to have been neglected, misunderstood, certainly wasn't anywhere near as successful as some of his contemporaries.
That's right. I mean, if you compare him to J.M.W. Turner, which people might be familiar with as another great British painter of the period, Turner, you know, in his early 20s, opened his own gallery, was incredibly successful, had more money than he could spend. But in conventional terms, Blake was totally unsuccessful. He had his own single solo show in 1809, which was an unmitigated failure. Very few people came to see it. Nobody bought anything, which obviously is key for an artist. And there was one very vicious newspaper review that slated both Blake and his work. But regardless, he kept going ahead. He was so dedicated to his ideas and his art. You know, he was trained in a conventional way. He had been an engraver, an apprentice engraver as a young man, spent 7 years. So he, you know, his bread and butter throughout his life was reproductive engraving. And yet, in his own time, he was creating these astonishing works, which were a combination of print, painting, and drawing on all sorts of inspiration. His own visions, famously, the Bible, works of literature like Milton's Paradise Lost and Shakespeare's plays and so on, and pulling them all together to create this very unique work.
And you say the visions, and he really is quite visionary. And looking at the beautiful exhibition book and the incredible illustrations there of the pieces of art, it seems that he's very much ahead of his time. I think that if he was around now in the 21st century, he would be acclaimed because the apocalyptic imagery and demons and the mythological figures, it would very much resonate with our time. And there's something very immediate in terms of everything that's happening in the world. And he kind of speaks to us very powerfully.
That's right. There is a kind of a universal quality about his work. And of course, he was living in a time of great turmoil. There was wars going on, the American Revolutionary Wars, the French Revolution. Of course, in Ireland, we had the 1798 Revolution. So the status quo was being challenged. There was a great sense of fear. You know, coming up to the end of the 18th century, there was this sense of, you know, was the world going to end, literally? And artists like, including Blake, were creating works of art that responded to that uncertainty in the world that obviously mirrors, sadly, our own world today.
Did people think he was mad?
Yes, very much so. In many of the references, it talks about him being mad, or that the ravings of a lunatic, that kind of awful language is bandied about at the time. And yet people who knew Blake well, particularly the group of artists who called themselves the Ancients, they understood him and, well, they admired him for his wisdom. But also, you know, they said that he would explain to people, if they asked, that the visions, what he saw, anyone could experience if they were open to it. But people were too bothered about making a living and money and so on to actually be open to the spirit world.
Alice, tell us about this wonderful exhibition, because it has been travelling all around the place. I think it was in Turin. It goes to different cities and different galleries, and then there's new dimensions. So there's a particular Irish slant on this one and different elements to it, and a beautiful book that goes with it that you contributed to. So tell me about the exhibition, the concept, the idea, and this wonderful tour that it's been doing.
Yeah, so the exhibition first went to Turin, and then it went to Budapest, and now it's in Dublin. So it's travelled around, which I think is quite exciting, because as Anne has just been saying, Blake was really not known in his lifetime. So I constantly wonder what he would have made of having his work shown in such wonderful settings and having such an international audience. But I guess the kind of roots for the show is that Tate has a really special collection of Blake's work. It's one of the kind of outstanding collections in the world. And Blake is one of our most treasured artists. I think his work has been on display since kind of almost constantly since the 1920s at Tate. So he is really one of the kind of artists that we see as a kind of key romantic figure alongside people like Turner and Constable. But he's often seen in isolation, which I think is part of how he was kind of perceived at the end of his life by the ancients and those young artists. They saw him as this kind of misunderstood genius who was kind of an outsider. And this show really feels like an opportunity to actually put Blake back into the context of his time and to think about the ways, the many ways in which British art kind of took on new directions in this time, faced with the turbulence of maybe American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, uprisings at home as well. Artists, it's this kind of moment of almost like a crisis of confidence, and there's a kind of puncture in British ambitions. So I think it's out of that that there's this new kind of romantic imagination that emerges, that's exploring ideas of subjectivity, of irrationality and emotion, of spirituality. And this is kind of something that we see across British art at this time. And so it's an opportunity to think about Blake within that as one of those artists that who is beginning to kind of take up these new themes in his work.
And I think that's one of the brilliant things about the exhibition, the fact that it's showing that he is part of this wider artistic world and he's not some kind of isolated genius. Can I talk about his approach to the Enlightenment and the dominance of reason? And he challenges a lot of the strong worldviews at the time because he has a different perception of what's needed.
Yeah, there's the very famous image he made of Newton, who is kind of shown so intent on his work that he's kind of missing this amazing landscape and world around him. And so for Blake, it's all about the imaginative world, and he kind of sees the world around him. I think he says this kind of wonderful line where he says, "To me, this world is all one continued vision of fancy or imagination." And he sees that really at getting to the truth and kind of universal themes. And so he's kind of running quite counter often to the kind of conventional morality and ideas of the day.
His illuminated books are extraordinary in the way he was able to combine poetry and the images. And it's, I think for me, that's something that really stands out, that we're not talking about a poet and we're not talking about an artist. We're talking about someone who so powerfully combines both of these things.
Yeah, and that was really important to him, that kind of dual identity. And it was in his prophetic books that he was able to express that the most. And he developed this unique way of printing, this relief printing process, in order to be able to combine word and image in the way that he does. And it remains kind of still a bit of a, we're still not entirely sure what his exact technique was. And he describes it in a very kind of mysterious way, describing it as an infernal method, melting away apparent surfaces. So for him, it was also this way of getting at the truth of things. And he said that the technique, actually, his younger brother Robert died very sadly, very young. And he said that it was Robert who came to him in a vision and told him about this new printing technique.
And I love the way in Ireland we sometimes like to claim figures as Irish. But what made me laugh is that this is a long tradition, and W.B. Yeats tried to claim Blake as Irish, I think on fairly spurious grounds. I think there was maybe a grandfather who was Irish or something. And but it was important for Yeats, and it really sees how he was very much influencing the literary scene at that time.
Absolutely. I've called my essay Fantasy and Fact, William Blake in Ireland, because of that. There is quite a lot of fantasy involved there. And Yeats, in fairness to him, was absolutely convinced that Blake had Irish heritage, and that his grandfather, John O'Neill, married a woman called Ellen Blake, and to, you know, escape debtors, took her name, you know, and so on. And yeah, W.B. Yeats said he got this from a descendant who lived in Spain or something. Anyway, that was important to him, but I think it was because of the way Blake looked to the world beyond that tangible world that we're all living in, which, you know, connected with the Irish interest in, you know, the spirit world and so on. And he made quite a good argument, but as early as 1906, a German scholar, Alain Richter, just blew Yeats out of the water on that line. You know, and yeah, we do that with many artists. Francis Bacon, who famously really didn't want to be associated with Ireland, we gather him into our collective bosom, I suppose. Yeah, so it's something we do very regularly. But there were strong connections between Blake and Irish characters, most notably James Barry, the Irish history painter, born in County Cork, spent most of his life working in London. But Blake was a great admirer of James Barry.
Yes, he seems to have been a huge influence on him, and there was huge respect there for the work that Barry was doing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in one of his notes, Blake mentions Barry as the really industrious, virtuous and independent Barry. And I think that word independent is key because, of course, Blake also is very independent. But he would have come across Barry when he was a student at the Royal Academy's drawing school, so in his early 20s. And from 1782, James Barry was professor of painting at the Royal Academy. And one of his jobs in that role was to give the annual lectures, or a number of lectures every year, on painting and drawing and so on. So Blake would have been listening to this and I suppose realising how important, you know, art was. And I'll just quote from lines from Barry's second lecture on design. He said that drawing was crucial in allowing the viewer to recognise those operations of imagination and judgment which constitute the ideal of art and show its high lineage as the offspring of philosophy and the sister of poetry. And of course, Blake's own work is very much pulling the two together, and it's very informed by his ideas, his thinking, and his knowledge of the Bible, for example, and of, you know, literary works from the 17th century and so on.
And both Barry and Blake were outsiders. Some of their contemporaries dismissed them as mad. There were these similarities there. And Barry, as you show, is a Catholic. And that, I think, influenced Blake then and his sympathies towards those who were suffering religious persecution.
Yeah, well, I suppose they were both outsiders in many senses, you know, in terms of religion. Blake was, his family were nonconformist dissenters, if you like, so they wouldn't have been attending the services of the established church. Barry, as you say, was Catholic, and Catholics were notoriously repressed and oppressed in this period. So I think Blake very much took the side of the persecuted always. And in 1780, when the Gordon riots took place, this was a huge uprising of, well, it was very much anti-Catholic feeling, which overran into the streets of London, and hundreds of people were actually killed. But Blake was sympathetic to the people who were being attacked at that time. And yes, certainly Barry and himself, in many different ways, both of them also, you know, really were keen that art, you know, that art was, could be prophetic. You know, the role of the artist as teacher was really important, and their deeply held beliefs were often held as radical by their peers and fellows. But, you know, art was absolutely the driving force for both of them.
Tina, you begin your wonderful essay with the discussion of the influence of Blake on people like writers such as Oscar Wilde, William Butler Yeats, James Joyce. And it's very interesting to see how he is connecting with these writers and poets, and how his influence and his legacy and his shadow is there for all of these writers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. It kind of goes back to the point that you made earlier about how important Blake is, but at the time he was pretty overlooked and neglected. And certainly we could say that's the case in Ireland. He probably wasn't that well known in his own lifetime, but he becomes incredibly influential towards the end of the 19th century with writers like Wilde, Yeats and Joyce, who very much found in him and in his work an important touchstone for their own.
And your chapter looks at it in context, and it looks at the world of Gothic literature. So tell us, what do we mean when we talk about Gothic literature, and where does Blake fit into that world?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's Gothic literature is one of these very kind of amorphous ideas. But generally speaking, when we think about first wave Gothic literature, so Gothic literature that emerged and developed in the latter half of the 18th century, we're thinking about literary modes that are dealing with, this literary mode that deals with the supernatural, for instance, with the feudal past and with kind of ideas of unjust rule. It's often very interested in notions of the sublime, as theorized in particular by Anglo-Irish philosopher Edmund Burke. We often have attention to kind of beleaguered heroines who have to kind of wend their way through a patriarchal world of violence, sometimes also beset by supernatural figures and forces that may or may not be shown to be actually supernatural by the end of the text. And Blake has there has been increasing attention in literary scholarship to the ways in which Blake was influenced by contemporary Gothic literature in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, and the ways in which then in his works we can see a kind of Gothic imagination emerging.
So maybe we might go back in time a little bit first to this previous age of romantic fantasy. And Alice, let's talk about some of the descriptions that we have of Blake. The painter and printmaker Samuel Palmer seems to have viewed him as a present-day prophet and called him a fitting companion for Dante. In him, you saw at once the maker, the inventor, one of the few in any age. And it is extraordinary the way, for those who were his disciples and supporters and followers, it's extraordinary to see how they viewed William Blake.
Yeah, and I think it was in this, in Blake's kind of 60s, so at the very end of his life, that he, through the artist and the landscape painter John Linnell, who was 26, and he met Blake in 1818, and it was through Linnell that Blake then met the ancients, so Samuel Palmer, Edward Calvert, Frederick Tatum, and George Richmond. And they were all in their late teens and their early 20s when they met Blake, and he made this really lasting impression on them, and they all really admired his work. They called him the interpreter, and I think it's their image of Blake as this kind of prophet-like figure who's, yeah, isolated, who's misunderstood by the world around him, because they're kind of meeting him when Blake really is in a kind of low ebb. He had this solo exhibition, which was a huge failure, and then he gradually retreats from the world, really. And also following the kind of the wars with France, there's a kind of downturn in the print trade as well. So the reproductive engraving that always kind of sustained him is perhaps not there. And he's really reliant on his friends and a few kind of key patrons to commission works that kind of keep him going. So he is in this kind of very precarious point of life when they meet him. So this image of kind of neglect is very, very potent to them and shows his commitment to his art and his commitment to his vision. And it's this image, and Palmer in particular, his memory of Blake really informs certainly how he was remembered in the 19th century, and I think really has a kind of enduring impact today. And I think Blake in many ways has kind of come to kind of almost be the archetypal romantic artist of a kind of a creative who's balancing his day job versus his own kind of creative projects that he did in the night, and then who is also, you know, willing to suffer for his art, that he's this inspired genius.
You mentioned his friends, and he did have some friends who really helped him and supported him, and his publisher Joseph Johnson, you show, was brilliant in providing him with commercial work, but also introducing him to a wide network of radicals, including the feminist Mary Wollstonecraft, the revolutionary author Thomas Paine, and I think this was a very important source, both in terms of the money but also these connections.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, Blake claimed that he had warned Thomas Paine that he would be kind of persecuted and ahead of time. I don't think that was particularly true, but it shows his kind of connections, and that it really shows that Blake was engaged in the radical ideas of the time, that the French Revolution in particular, with its ideas of liberty and equality, really appealed to many people, and it became a kind of political touchstone for protest, and particularly within that kind of radical middle class circle that was very much kind of Johnson's milieu. And so Blake was very much at the heart of that in those years.
There was also a wonderfully named group called the Ancients, a group of young artists who venerated Blake for his vision and his otherworldliness. And they seemed to have gathered around him, or certainly were hugely devoted disciples of him.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting that they were commissioning works from Blake, but also they took on many of his values. I think Blake, because of his really distinctive vision and his kind of the originality of his art and poetry, doesn't have any followers or disciples in the kind of strict sense that we might think of within the art world. But he certainly inspires people, I think, to take certain aspects of his art and move that forward in their own work. So for the Ancients, they kind of rejected what they saw as the modern world around them, and particularly in light of the industrialization of the time. And they retreated to the village of Shoreham in Kent, where they took a visionary approach to the landscape around them. So they were very much engaged with the kind of spirituality and nature, in taking that from Blake in particular. There were a particular set of wood engravings of the pastorals by Blake that the Ancients particularly admired. I think Palmer described them as glimmering.
Alice, you describe his wife Catherine, who he married in 1782, as the most important person in his adult life, someone who unwaveringly believed in his visionary genius, who looked after the household and the finances. She was also a practicing artist herself. And that relationship and her devotion to Blake seems to have been such a vital part of his story.
Yeah, and often I think until kind of more recently, often a kind of less known part of the story. But yeah, he married Catherine in 1782, and she had this really instrumental role. I think she provided the kind of stability that he needed to be able to pursue his art. So she would take charge of, I guess, the domestic responsibilities and the finances on a very practical level. But she was an artist in her own right as well. And she also helped Blake with printing and with colouring his works as well, so that the hand colouring. So she's really vital in understanding his work.
But yet in some of the other accounts, or in maybe in the popular imagination, Blake is the champion of free love, and he's not someone who's a strong believer in marriage, and there is a very different image of Blake that we see presented as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And in his writing he does kind of challenge conventional ideas around sexuality in particular. But he was, I think, in his own way, very devoted to Catherine. And he would get up every morning and light the fires for her and things like that. So their relationship was really an important part of his life.
Well, tonight we are talking history, and we are talking about the life and legacy and indeed the work of the artist and writer William Blake. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll find out about the impact of the French and American revolutions on his thinking. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the life, work and legacy of William Blake. And there's a brilliant new exhibition in the National Gallery of Ireland. It's running until the 19th of July. It's called William Blake, The Age of Romantic Fantasy. And I'm delighted to be able to talk about this wonderful exhibition and about this remarkable figure with the three people who put together the wonderful book that accompanies the exhibition: Anne Hodge, the creator of prints and drawings at the National Gallery of Ireland, and she's the creator and the co-creator of this exhibition; Dr. Alice Inslee, the creator of British Art 1730 to 1850 at Tate Britain and the co-creator of the William Blake exhibition; and Dr. Christina Moran, professor of English at the University of Limerick. She's also the Assistant Dean of Research for the Faculty of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences there. And before we talk about the French and American revolutions, let's talk about the influence or the connections, the links with Dante, because we seem to always see people comparing him or mentioning him in the same breath as Dante. And then towards the end of his life, Dante seems to become a huge focus of his work.
That's right. Well, as I mentioned earlier, the Bible was a huge inspiration also. And from quite an early point, you know, the beginning of the 19th century, he was creating works taken from the Book of Job, notably for a very important patron called Thomas Butts. Butts was literally a civil servant, but who was so interested in Blake's work that he commissioned many, many different works. So Job had been going along inspiring Blake for quite a long time. And then he had also looked at Dante and obviously the Divine Comedy, where Dante imagines himself being taken through the circles of hell with Virgil, the great poet of ancient Rome. So he took this on. The imagery is quite incredible. And the last project that he embarked upon in the very last years of his life was to illustrate 100 scenes from basically Dante's Inferno, because Blake seemed to be more interested in representing hell. It had more imaginative possibilities, I think, than heaven, even though obviously the two characters did go through heaven as well. So in the last room of the exhibition, we have six of the beautiful watercolour drawings where Blake, you know, imagines what hell was like through Dante's words. And famously, he's said to have learned Italian so that he could read Dante's writings in the original text. And there's a very poignant, one of the drawings in the exhibition shows Dante and Virgil just at the gates of hell, literally looking in into what is ahead of them. And you can see the circles indicated as sort of hills running into the distance with icicles and all sorts of scary effects. But as the characters stand at the gates of hell, above there's an inscription in Blake's own handwriting, and it's slightly shaky. You get the sense of an old man at this point. So he has the Italian line at the top, and then underneath, in slightly wonky translation, I would say, in English, and basically it's, you know, abandon hope, all ye who enter here. And I wonder as well, that idea of, you know, Blake maybe being very, very aware of his own mortality. He was coming near the end of his life. But he was so excited by this project. Even though he was in ill health, he would sit up in bed, because he wasn't so mobile towards the end, he would sit up in bed with a big drawing board, the sheet of paper pasted on, and he would work away. And he wrote to John Linnell, who was the patron who commissioned this whole series of illustrations. He wrote saying, I've no time for anything else, only Dante. And describes, you know, the baffled devils fighting, which was the plate he was working on at the time. Of course, it was more difficult for him to engrave from his bed. Well, he couldn't really. And in the end, he only engraved 7 of what should have been a series of about 100 prints, which Linnell had imagined. And Linnell held on to the plates after Blake's death and printed them later, as late as I think 1874. He brought out another edition of those prints. But they're really quite fascinating and totally bizarre. And again, that comes back to the thing that why are they still interested in Blake? It's because he's so unusual, so unique. And we can, you know, imagine weird and wonderful things through looking at his art.
Was he a religious man, given that he has these biblical inspirations, and given that he is wrestling with these great moral questions and these great, great images of demons and the apocalypse and so on? Do you think he was a believer? Was he religious?
He was absolutely a believer. His own religion, maybe an own is the key word there, was unorthodox. So he took the ideas of the Bible and so on, but made them his own. And famously, a diarist of the time, Henry Crabb Robinson, was speaking with Blake about, you know, God and various things, and asking him, did he believe? And Blake said, absolutely, yes, certainly it infuses his work. Blake kept creating his art, and he would speak with anyone who was interested about, you know, what he saw and what he believed in. So yes, very much a believer.
Alice, reading your essay, one thing that struck me was that we're very well aware, I think, in our country, across Europe, about the impact of the French Revolution, but we perhaps underestimate sometimes the impact of the American Revolution. And you remind us of how it divided public opinion. It ended in national trauma in Britain. And in that big debate, Blake, like his friend and hero James Barry, was on the side of the revolutionaries.
Yeah, he definitely saw it as a kind of, as the revolutionaries kind of rising up against a kind of tyrannical government, and that he was very much on the side of the revolutionaries. Yes, and I think the kind of the fallout of that, I think, for Britain and the kind of loss of their first colony had quite a big impact nationally and did cause embarrassment. And it also shifted Britain's imperial interest to India and the Caribbean in particular. So it was a kind of sea change moment in that respect as well. But I think it was also from this moment where the kind of nation's ambitions gets really shaken, and suddenly that image of themselves as a kind of world power gets punctured in many ways. And so I think it's this moment that really sparks this imaginative response, and particularly I think in the way that artists began to look to the national past for kind of new stories that might legitimize their kind of history and also colonializing projects, and be a kind of new source for national pride. So I don't think it's necessarily a surprise that people like Shakespeare and Milton come to the fore in this time as well.
Well, it's interesting what you say about Shakespeare, because that's one of the things I was going to ask you about, because you talk about how Britain was in crisis and art itself seemed to be in crisis. And then you had artists like Henry Fuseli. One of the images in the exhibition book is his painting of Lady Macbeth seizing the daggers. And it was how there was this almost seemed to be a break between what was high art and what was low art, or what was considered to be for the education and what was for the public. And you see these blurring of the lines between these things as art goes through its own transformation.
Yeah, in the kind of, I guess, in the years that Blake was really embarking as an artist, in 1768, the Royal Academy was founded. And that's a really key moment for the professional status of art in Britain. And it's a moment where the role of art in the nation is proclaimed and its importance is recognised. And within the kind of artistic hierarchy of the day, history painting, which were these very grand, ambitious pictures that took kind of moments from literature, history, mythology, the classics, as their subject to kind of present a moralising lesson, that was seen as the very pinnacle of art of the day. And if you were a history painter like James Barry, then you were seen as working at the very top of the kind of artistic hierarchy. But the reality was that there wasn't a market for this. And so many artists didn't pursue that. Or you see Reynolds, for example, taking on some of these ideas, but actually mainly painting portraiture. And so it seemed like the art that was valued the most wasn't actually sustaining anyone. And that's where you get artists like Fuseli, who, within the context of public exhibitions for contemporary art, which was new for the time and a kind of whole new way of meeting a new audience, you see artists trying to appeal to the audience's emotions and being sensationalist to attract attention. And still, for Fuseli, he's still working in the language of history painting, but he is making it much more appealing to exhibition goers by, you know, picking a kind of shocking scene in Macbeth and of emphasizing the psychological intensity, that very stark monochrome. They're all intended to kind of attract attention and stand out from the crowd.
And then it's very interesting to look at the response and the impact to the French Revolution, because there is an initial wave of enthusiasm, but then when the king and queen are executed and Britain goes to war with France, there's a backlash, there's repression, and the world changes again then, and it becomes a much more paranoid place as well. And you see that even when Blake is arrested and he's put on trial in 1804, and it's part of that context of this concern about what's happening in the world and the contagion of these revolutionary ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that actually Blake had written about the French Revolution, but Joseph Johnson didn't publish it in the end, I guess because it would have become too inflammatory. And there really is this moment where radical politics is much more under scrutiny. And very famously, Blake gets arrested actually for apparently damning the king and the trial is in January in 1804, and he's found innocent, and there probably wasn't much truth to the claim, but it does show how even something as seemingly minor as that suddenly becomes much more provocative, and it's deemed enough to take to arrest Blake. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that if his illuminated books, his prophetic books, had have had a wider audience and a wider readership, then they would have been potentially very dangerous to Blake. His ideas were really radical and would have been seen as very inflammatory at the time.
And it's funny how an altercation with a drunken soldier leads to a trial for sedition and this charge of having damned the king, and how one thing leads to another.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that moment kind of really shook Blake, and he returns to London after that. It was at a time when he was staying with his friend William Haley in Sussex. And so after that, he kind of comes back to London and tries to reestablish himself within the London art world.
And Tina, that brings us then very nicely on to then that impact in the later 19th century, and about how so many people kind of take up the work of Blake, are influenced by Blake, and how it very much shapes new writings and new pieces of art in that century.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Yeats, beyond kind of identifying Blake rather incorrectly as Irish, basically argues that Blake's writing is intrinsically Irish. And this connects to some of what was going on in literary revival. And it's kind of look back to Ireland's kind of mythological and mythic past, and the kind of interest in creating and fostering a truly Irish literature. So we see Blake's influence kind of coming in there for sure. I suppose it is interesting just to go back to the question of the French Revolution and thinking about the kind of influence of Gothic and Gothic literature at the time that Blake was writing and producing his art. Because the Gothic is often linked to revolution and to rebellion. Jarlath Killeen in Trinity has argued that the Gothic is always a kind of transitional mode, in that it emerges and seeks to deal with moments of transition. And in the late 18th century, Gothic literature in particular becomes kind of linked to rebellious activity in its kind of encouragement of extremes of emotion, of fear, of terror, but pleasure, linked pleasure. It's seen to kind of foment rebellious thinking and rebellious activity in its kind of encouragement of this idea of the lone woman thrown onto her own devices, having to make her way in the world on her own. And it's kind of linked to female readers in particular. It's kind of seen as a dangerous form of literature that's kind of encouraging revolutionary activity. And it's even more upsetting because this is encouraging revolutionary activity at home.
And Edmund Burke features in this very strongly as well, with his writings on the sublime and the beautiful and on the French Revolution. And that very much is part of the story then as well.
Yeah, 100%. And Burke's ideas of the sublime, which he kind of outlines in his treatise, 1757 work on the sublime and the beautiful, where he kind of gives this very Enlightenment contrast of what is the sublime and what is the beautiful. And he talks about the sublime as the most intense emotion the mind is capable of feeling. And he links it in particular to a kind of experience of mixed fear and pleasure. And that becomes hugely influential in the development of Gothic literature over the course of the late 18th and into the early 19th centuries.
And something your essay shows so brilliantly is that, you know, we've been talking about British identity and what it's going through in this period, but Ireland is going through similar kind of debates when you have the impact of the American and French Revolution, but then the impact of 1798, the Act of Union, when the Irish Parliament is abolished. And that's being taken up in this new Irish literature, and it's very much influencing that cultural world at this time as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we tend to think in the early 19th century, particularly in the aftermath of the Anglo-Irish Union, that Irish writers developed new literary forms like the national tale to kind of deal with this new relationship and with this new idea of Ireland. But actually, we see Gothic literature already kind of dealing with those ideas in the run-up to the 1798 rebellion and indeed after the Act of Union. And also the national tale, which we associate with Sidney Owens and Lady Morgan in particular, with her novel The Wild Irish Girl from 1807. These novels often work with the Gothic mode as well to think about the relationship between England and Ireland, the relationship between the past and the present. We like to think of these two forms or modes, the national tale and the Gothic, as being fundamentally separate, but they're not at all.
Well, tonight we are talking about the life, work and legacy of William Blake. And we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be assessing his remarkable legacy with our panel of experts. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history. And tonight we're talking about the life, work and legacy of the remarkable artist and poet William Blake. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel of experts, Anne Hodge, creator of Prints and Drawings at the National Gallery of Ireland and the co-creator of that wonderful new exhibition, William Blake, The Age of Romantic Fantasy, and it's running until the 19th of July. Dr. Alice Inslee, creator of British art at Tate Britain and the co-creator of the exhibition, and Dr. Christina Moran, professor of English at the University of Limerick. And all three are the authors of the wonderful exhibition book that accompanies it. And it really is a work of art in its own right, with all of the wonderful illustrations and drawings and colour images inside it, as well as the three wonderful essays as well. Tina, when we're talking about the legacy of Blake, is one of the legacies the Irish literary revival, because Yeats seems to have drawn so much from it, and historians such as Roy Foster have kind of linked it back to that romantic period and its influence and its connections.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Roy Foster has, I think, very astutely pointed out that Irish romanticism, more of Irish romanticism than we like to think of, actually influenced the Irish literary revival and continued to kind of influence later 19th century writers. And I think we definitely see that in Yeats's kind of attraction to Blake. He wrote two essays on Blake's art, William Blake and the Imagination, and William Blake and his illustrations to the Divine Comedy. He also produced that kind of three-volume edition of Blake's works where he makes that claim that Blake is actually Irish and that his work is intrinsically Irish. And I think for Yeats, what Blake did, and Anne kind of alluded to this earlier, Blake's way of dealing with the spiritual, with going back to ideas of myth, really appealed to what he was trying to do in the literary revival, to kind of celebrate Irish national culture and literature, in part through a kind of revival or a recreation of traditional poetry and legends of Ireland. And again, this links back to the Romantic period and the Romantic period's interest in antiquarian endeavors, where the kind of myths and legends and ballads of Ireland were being collected and written down. So we see the kind of oral culture of Ireland being preserved, but also preserved and also refashioned in a way. Blake is hugely influential in that sense.
And what would you like people to take away from the exhibition, if and hopefully when they visit it? What insights, what ideas?
People are responding brilliantly. Anyone who does come in is very excited to see these works that are very iconic. And the fact that in this exhibition we see William Blake, who people are kind of familiar with, in the company of his peers and artists of the time. And those ideas that Alice and Tina have been talking about of what was going on in the world, the turmoil, the revolution and so on. So I think what they could basically... Each person, I think, will take something different from the exhibition. Some people will just be fascinated by the colour, the different techniques that are on display, and trying to work out how exactly did Blake use print and painting on the same sheet to create this glowing image. Other people will be interested in the horror, the drama. For instance, there's an amazing avalanche scene by Philip de Lutherberg, a Swiss-born artist who very much is influenced by Burke's The Sublime and the Beautiful Ideas. And it's a really a terror-filled scene. But if you look very closely, you'll see just a little hand reaching up, looking for help as the ice and snow cover the person. So, you know, there's drama, there's intrigue, and also there's a little bit of humour in there too, if you care to find it. So certainly we've done our best in putting on this show to create a great sense of atmosphere. The colours are very deep. There's the lighting is very dramatic. So yeah, I think it will be exciting for people to see. And it is a historical moment because we have not in Ireland had a public exhibition of Blake's work.
Alice, I'm going to leave the final word to you. Why do you think Blake matters, and why do you think he resonates so much in our time now, and what is the real, I suppose, the legacy of William Blake?
I think it's his extraordinary originality and vision, and I think it's his creativity is so rich that I think we can look at his art and everyone takes something different from it. And I think that's why he's had such an enduring impact on the visual arts and on literature, because I think each new generation finds their own Blake. And I think one of the kind of key things for me is that I think Blake has shaped the way that we think about artists more broadly. He is this kind of archetypal romantic artist who's this inspired genius and who is committed to his work. I think that has had this really important legacy in the way that we think about what it is to be an artist.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. William Blake, The Age of Romantic Fantasy. You can go see it for yourself in the National Gallery of Ireland until the 19th of July. And my thanks to my wonderful panel of experts for bringing the life and work of William Blake to us tonight. Anne Hodge, Creator of Prints and Drawings at the National Gallery of Ireland, Dr. Alice Inslee, Creator of British Art at Tate Britain, and Dr. Christina Moran, Professor of English at the University of Limerick. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We'll be back next week with more debate and discussion. We've been Talking History. Good night.